I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Henry Steinberg, a brilliant student of poetry and of representations of the Holocaust, a leader of our letterpress project, the Robinson Press, a poet who has performed in the We All Feel Like It series, which I think is hosted by one of our other guests, Michelle Taransky. Is that correct, Michelle?
That's correct.
And a panelist in our 2009 Umlaut Machine event celebrating Christian Buck. And by the aforementioned Michelle Taransky, whose poems have appeared in How To, New American Writing, Drunken Boat, Continental Review, and elsewhere, and whose book Barn Burned Then was selected by Marjorie Welsh for the Omnidon Poetry Prize with degrees from Chicago and Iowa. Which of those two degrees do you prefer? Which is most practical? Don't answer that. Chicago and Iowa. Michelle is a member of the Writer's House staff, a teacher of critical writing, and also the book review editor of Jacket 2. I hesitate to say that on Poem Talk, lest you get, you know, more people wanting to review, but maybe it's too late. And by Peter Cole, poet and translator who spends half the year in Jerusalem and half in New Haven. I'm not going to ask you which you prefer. Among whose books of poems is Things on Which I've Stumbled of 2008, whose anthology The Dream of the Poem is subtitled Hebrew Poetry in Muslim and Christian Spain, 950 to 1492, and whose Sacred Trash, written with his wife Adina Hoffman, tells the story of the recovery of a crucial cache of Hebrew manuscripts, and who is one of our most talented translators of contemporary Hebrew, and also of Arabic poetry. Welcome back to the third floor of the Writer's House, Michelle and Henry. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. Henry, to Poem Talk for the very first time. So glad you do this with us.
It's good to be here.
And Peter, thank you for making your way from New Haven today. We really appreciate
it. My pleasure.
And I'm happy to say that Peter was here earlier to record a new trove of his poems and some translations for his Penn Sound page. So you go to Penn Sound and you type Peter Cole in the search box. Well, today we're here to talk about two short poems or short sections of longer poems by Charles Reznikoff. The first is known as Salmon and Red Wine from its first line, section 23 of the series called Inscriptions, 1944-1956. The first line of our second poem is, during the Second World War, I was going home one night. And this is section 28 of part 2 of a series called By the Well of Living and Seeing, which was published in 1969 in the book that gathered that series, along with the fifth book of the Maccabees. Our recording of the first poem was made at the Poetry Center of San Francisco State in 1974. The second was recorded when Reznikoff was a guest on Susan Howe's radio program in 1975. So here now, reading Salmon and Red Wine, and then during the Second World War, I was going home one night, is Charles Reznikoff.
Salmon and red wine, and a cake fat with raisins and nuts. No diet for a writer of verse who must learn to fast and drink water by measure. Those of us without house and ground who leave tomorrow must keep our baggage light. A psalm, perhaps a dialogue, brief as Lamech's song in Genesis, even Job among his friends, but no more. Like a tree in December after the winds have stripped it, leaving only trunk and limbs to ride and outlast the winter's blast. During the Second World War, I was going home one night along a street I seldom used. All the stores were closed except one, a small fruit store. An old Italian was inside to wait on customers. As I was paying him, I saw that he was sad. "You are sad," I said. "What is troubling you?" "Yes," he said, "I am sad." Then he added, in the same monotone, not looking at me, "My son left for the front today,
and I'll never see him again. Don't say that, I said. Of course you will. No, he answered. I'll never see him again. Afterwards, when the war was over, I found myself once more in that street. And again it was late at night, dark and lonely. And again I saw the old man alone in the store. I bought some apples and looked closely at him. His thin, wrinkled face was grim, but not particularly sad. How about your son, I said. Did he come back from the war? Yes, he answered. He was not wounded? No. He is all right. That's fine, I said. Fine. He came back at Christmas, he added. How wonderful. That was wonderful. Yes, he said gently. It was wonderful. He took the bag of apples from my hands and, groping inside, took out one of the smaller apples and put in a large one.
Well, these are two very different poems, read just a year apart. I think we put them together because in some ways they demonstrate a variety of the short pieces. But first, let's start with Salmon and Red Wine. So before we get to the epigraph, which is not in the reading, we should talk about that. Somebody just talk about Reznikov's voice, his tone. Henry, what do you think when you hear this?
I think it's wonderful. I love his voice. It's so high-pitched and nasal. And I guess reading the poem, I wouldn't think of that kind of voice. It almost has like a rabbinical intonation in the words themselves. But
rabbinical in the sense of... We feel like we're being taught something. He knows an answer that we don't quite get yet. Maybe like, didactic?
I guess. I feel like when I say rabbinical, I mean like as though he's conveying some sort of truth that we're not party to yet.
Wise and proverbial, maybe.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Michelle, tone of voice?
Yes, I think this is the tone of voice of someone who's in conversation with an audience. And though I do see what Henry's saying about the rabbinical, the telling, it also seems like a voice that's questioning and wavering and ready for a revision.
Well, what I meant was that I felt that there was a difference between the spoken, the performance, and the tone of the piece as I read it.
Can I throw in that he sounds like William Carlos Williams to me?
Yeah, well, that also
does that
just
mean
maybe
something?
It may just simply be something to do with age.
Age and size.
Yeah.
Regional.
The way the voice changes over time. I went back and listened on the Penn site, and there are other recordings of Reznikov reading Salmon and Red Wine. And the earliest one I found, just from a few years earlier, 1969, I think we were talking before, is very different. And it's much more the way he reads during the Second World War. It's much more the way I've imagined him speaking and the way people talk about Reznikov with his gentleness and his sort of quietness.
And plainness, would you
and
say?
And plainness, yeah. And in fact, there's a lot to talk about in terms of what's rabbinic here, but one of the things that's rabbinic as I see it, and we can get to that more, with the epigraph is that plainness, which is just so much a part of who he is.
Salmon and red wine, and a cake fat with raisins and nuts. No diet for a writer of verse who must learn to fast and drink water by measure. Those of us without house and ground who leave tomorrow must keep our baggage light. A psalm, perhaps a dialogue.
So let's talk about that line. Those of us without house and ground, excluding what we know about the epigraph, which we'll talk about in a second, what does that refer to in common sense terms, Henry? Those of us without house or ground. Is this person homeless, in exile, in diaspora?
I guess I would think diaspora. Immediately I thought of like those who are forced to leave their towns, their homes, their villages, the shtetls. Specifically Jews, but more specifically, like Peter was saying, everyone who's been forced at some time to move by some like incurring force.
And outside, Michelle, outside the epigraph, which is going to use the term ground, ground means terra firma, it means location, it means also the opposite of theory, I suppose. What do you do with that?
I read that as a kind of girding that we all might have, and that, just to pick up on what Henry and Peter were both saying, like I too see it, that you could read it as the diaspora, but also as Reznikov sort of writing about those other neglected histories or those others.
Those of us without a tradition?
Or those of us away from a place that feels like or is home.
So let's go to the epigraph. I'm going to ask Henry to sort of explain what he thinks the epigraph says, and then we'll open it up in the plainest sort of way, and then we'll open it up to try to figure out why the use of the Mishnah and how it relates to ground again. So I'll read the epigraph. Henry, you comment. Thou shalt eat bread with salt, and thou shalt drink water by measure, and on the ground shalt thou sleep, and thou shalt live a life of trouble. And then there's an ellipsis and a reference to the Mishnah.
Well, I guess in the most basic sense, it's sort of dictating a controlled, almost ascetic life. Some, like, a life of penance, maybe, a religious life, something.
But why sleep on the ground? Because that's a different ground than the one we were talking about.
Well, it's a different about. It's a different ground. It's the actual, I'm assuming, actual ground.
Meaning no bed.
The floor, no bed, no comfort.
Poem, it turns into without ground.
Yeah.
Weird.
Different, yes.
But in both cases, it's trouble. In both cases, it's a kind of suffering. Right. In the Mishnah, it's suffering. The person is literally sleeping on the ground.
In the Mishnah passage, though, it ends with, if you do all this, you'll be happy.
Well, if you continue, in the Mishnah, it says the person who does all this, and who is the person, is the Torah scholar, the student of Torah, which is the law, which brings us back to Reznikov. We can get to that in a second. But it says that if you do these things, it will be good for you, and you will be fortunate in this world and in the world to come. So in other words, if you dedicate yourself to this law,
right,
good things will happen to you. So Reznikov cuts that off. He just emphasizes the trouble that you're going to get. But the elision here is between, as I see it, between the Torah or the law and poetry, and the student of the law and the poet.
Okay, so Michelle, connect the dots then. Yeah. He begins the poem by saying, yeah, all this wonderful, rich, kind of fun, fattening food, not for me. Then he goes back to the epigraph that he doesn't read in the performance, which reinforces that kind of impoverishment for the sake of the art. Okay, connect those two. Maybe this is easy, maybe this is hard.
I think I'm going to offer a more secular reading, which would be one, say, someone who doesn't know Mishnah or Torah or Halakha, that for me, what Reznikov does here and in so many of his poems is he takes this sort of terrible, unfortunate situation, the actual situation of diaspora, and is able to turn it into a kind of opportunity to recognize something, to see something in those things that exist that maybe is not suffering or horrible, but that it's that pressure on what is there to see.
Is this possibly an affirmation of diaspora life?
I don't know if it's an affirmation, but I think it is a kind of picture of one way that one could see it or experience it.
Why wouldn't it be, Peter?
Well,
why wouldn't it be?
Yeah,
I'd almost go as far as say that a radical reading of this suggests, even though I think he, I don't know Reznikov's biography that well, but I know he had a period of Zionism, yet this almost strikes me as, I don't want to say anti-Zionist, but, you know, all that milk and honey stuff, I think I need to be out in the cold.
Uh-huh. Or that all the things
How crazy a reading is that?
What were you going
to
say?
Or that all the things that one would find in Israel to construct that sort of wonderful life, you might be able to find in the horrible life of diaspora, that you can
where
gather those
December
things.
And the bear, it's almost like Stephen's The Snowman
cake.
Gets affirmed, or Stephen's No Possum, No Sop, No Taters, all that wintriness in the poetic tradition, that certainly the North American Emersonian poetic tradition is, you know, all the riches are going to be if you deny yourself all this salmon and red wine and fat cake, you know.
Yeah,
Peter, what do you think? Is that crazy?
I agree. Yes, I think it's crazy. I agree with the first half.
Thank you for being so honest about that.
Of what Michelle said, in that, well, first of all, the Mishnah is written in the land of Israel. So if we want to go back to that. So it's not about diaspora. I don't think diaspora has anything to do with this. And I don't think diaspora has anything to do with Reznikov by and large in that sense. He's a Mishnaic poet. What do I mean by that? Mishnah is this book of law that covers every facet of daily life, of life, period. Every little thing is described. And it's a very simple, clear Hebrew that is arranged according to certain patterns, so that through its kind of prosaic taxonomy of reality, a certain poetry emerges. That's Reznikov. Reznikov somewhere says, what do I do as a poet? My job is to name, to name, and to name, and to name again until a rhythm emerges.
But what I think is interesting is that, especially with this epigraph, he eliminates the conclusion of his quote. He doesn't go on to say that if you do this, you'll be happy. Because, I mean, he was a student of law who abandoned the practice of law to go on and write poetry. So he didn't continue as the Torah scholar Mishnaic sense.
Well, what he's doing is, as I see it, is he's eliding these two. In the same way that Rodin somewhere says, if you're reading the An Imitation of Christ and you substitute the word sculpture for God, it works. Most of the time. That's sort of what he's done here. I mean, Reznikov is a secular Jew. He's not a religious Jew. Sometimes there's a lot of sentimentality, but basically it's a kind of humanistic Judaism that he's working out. And so he was trained as a lawyer. He worked for this law journal. His sensibility was cut really in that legal term vocabulary. And he's then, not in this poem is uncharacteristic, but in the bulk of his poems, he then applies that sort of Mishnaic way of looking at the world to wherever he happens to be, in New York, mostly New York, obviously.
And for me, this is Reznikov, as he is, doing, regardless of what there is, the things that he's naming and finding and making an order with. It's a poetics of care. It's a sort of one that is very invested in organizing it in a way that you're going to, I mean, I read these and I feel reminded of a New York that isn't, or I feel hopeful in a way that I know I can see the tenement and I can see the depression and all of that, but that it's his poetics of care that's able to turn it into something that we could talk about like we would talk about Mishnah.
And it's care for the smallest, most inconspicuous aspects of one's day, of one's reality. Just as the Mishnah does that with things that you don't, the most minute particle of existence, it has a law for that too. It has a way to organize and order that as well. And so it's that, the way I see it, as a motto, is that he's introducing poetry to a place where there are other people didn't see poetry. He's sort of saying, there's a frame. The frame is called poetry. Everybody's looking for it over here where outlast and blast rhyme.
Yeah.
But he's saying, no. Just move the frame, as in during the Second World War, and suddenly the whole world contains this poetry if it's just ordered in a certain way.
It's interesting that's terrific, Peter. Thank you. And there's a... Williams almost becomes a cognate. He really is doing, you can see broken shards of green glass between the walls of a hospital. Right.
But he's more extreme than
he
Williams.
He seems more extreme. That's what's so beautiful in working this out.
He's so concrete that he becomes conceptual. In other words, his concretion is so radical that he makes you ask at all points, is this a poem?
Right.
And so it reconceptualizes the notion of poetry, and where is it? And in a certain sense, you can say it's greater than Williams. I'm not saying it is, but you could, along this line of argument, for Williams, it has to do with a certain kind of intensity of epiphany. For Reznikov, in so many of these poems, he's saying, no, it's everywhere at all times if you just know how to see it, and therefore, in a kind of utilitarian sense, it's the greater good available to the greater number of people, and therefore more valuable.
So that perfectly sets us up for a discussion of the second poem, because if the first poem is itself an example of these ideas and is a kind of ars poetica, the second poem is an instance.
Exactly.
And so now let's get to the instance. So, Henry, a story has been told, resolutely focused on a dialogue, a lot of monosyllables. It's a simple story. And there are all kinds of things that the Reznikovian figure who wanders into an Italian grocer store, an Italian store, doesn't say about things he might want to say. So can you tell us the literal story, just briefly, what happens?
The literal story is he's walking down a street at night, sees a fruit stand, goes in, sees that the vendor is troubled, decides to talk to him, asks him what his troubles are. He says his son has just been drafted, called out to the front, and he says, oh my, that's what a horrible shame. And he says, well, don't worry, you'll see your son again. And the vendor says, no, I won't. And then flash forward to after the war, he goes back to the same shop, talks to the vendor again, asks him about his son. He says that he returned, he's fine, everything's better. They share a moment where...
And the final gesture is...
The vendor reaches into his bag, takes out a small apple and puts in...
Gives him a slightly better apple at the end.
Better apples. There's a discrepancy in the recording.
Yes, we're going to have to talk about that. But the gist is right. How do we understand this gesture? Is it meant to be seen as too slight, or is it meant to be seen as absolutely wonderfully human and generous in context? Michelle, your thought?
I would assume that Reznikov is not turning this apple giving into a metaphor or a simile or a moment. He's just saying it happened. It happened just like this other thing I didn't write or we're not reading happened. And that it's for the reader to sort of...
So if we were to read this as a short story by some spare short story writer, let's say Hemingway in his time, or I don't know, Raymond Carver's never quite like this, but you know, some minimalist, we're left to want to understand the gesture. You're saying that would be a mistake.
Well, I mean, perhaps because I'm preparing to teach Soliloquy by Kenneth Goldsmith in a few moments, but that for me, this is just an overheard bit of conversation in the snow of conversation in New York. And Reznikov, though he is asserting the I here, is not saying that I'm the important I or I'm the only I, but that I'm an I, this is this other I, and we're talking, we care about this son, we care about this war.
Peter, I just want to note, before I turn to you on this, that the word conceptual was used by you.
Yep.
And then I...
It's you said it's so this that it's almost conceptual.
It's so concrete.
And then Kenneth Goldsmith was referred to by Michelle in a poem talk about Charles Reznikov. I just wanted to point that out. Either we have conceptualism on our brains, or we're starting to see something in Reznikov. What is it, Peter, that we're starting to see in Reznikov?
Well, I think it goes back to, first of all, that what I mentioned before, Reznikov saying, my job is to name and to name and to name. He said that against, it's in Man and Poet somewhere, that's against the symbolists. Yeah, their job is to evoke, right? So he saw himself as doing something, you know, precisely opposed.
Do we have a name for that? Is there an ism for that? There really isn't, but I'll ask.
Well, I think this is a kind of metonymy of attention, right? This doesn't stand for anything except for what it is. If you want to talk about, I mean, the real beauty for Reznikov for me is this givenness, the respect he has for the facticity of things, the givenness of existence. Doesn't need any similes. It doesn't need the thing that Aristotle says makes poetry, metaphor. It doesn't need any of the flourishes that go with the salmon and the red wine.
I'm just going to be silly devil's advocate here. You know, I grew up in the 20th century, and I was, you know, Freud was Americanized in the 50s. I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and so all I want to do is try to understand what's not being said. And to me, what's not being said is, I don't usually go in this neighborhood. You know, the therapist would say, Charles, why did you take that? Why did you find yourself on a street you never, and you're in an Italian neighborhood? But you're Jewish and you went to the Italian neighborhood and you're asking this guy about his losses during World War II. And he's got a survivor son who was fighting for the Allies. And what's not being said is, what about the Jewish losses and how do I feel, meaning Reznikov or the I? Isn't that what's not being said here? And isn't that what we have to think about?
Well, maybe, but...
but go with me. Is it unreasonable?
Well, because what's not being said in Reznikov is basically everything that Reznikov is writing about.
Yeah.
Right? That's what the other poets are not saying. And that's why he ended up having to write a poem like Salmon and Red Wine, and it's why he had to publish his own poetry all those years and publish them in the poems first in Menorah Journal.
Right.
And, you know, so what wasn't getting said was these poems. That's also part of it. Mm. And he walked everywhere. So that night he went down a street he seldom went down. But he walked everywhere.
So if I'm looking for the Holocaust in here, I'm doing so in vain, you're saying.
Well, I wouldn't say
I would be as daring as to put this, I don't know if daring is the right word, but to put this poem on my syllabus for a course in the Holocaust, because in a way, thinking about what a parent loses during World War II for a Jew in America, it seems to be
right? I wouldn't object to seeing it on your syllabus. This is a poem where he's basically, it all comes, it's all about the tension in his attention to this man, this simple guy, this ordinary guy. Out of that tension, he's like a magician. He pulls this story and makes this big thing out of nothing. So here, by paying attention to that moment of fear and anxiety and love all mixed together, without calling it any of these things or giving it the sparest definition, Reznikov gives you this little vignette. Again, the frame is here. Now we have a poem. It's a kind of a ready-made found poem. It's not ready-made, but he made it. But it seems like it's ready-made.
"How about your son?" I said. "Did he come back from the war?" "Yes," he answered. "He was not wounded?" "No. He is all right." "That's fine," I said. "Fine." "He came back at Christmas," he added. "How wonderful. That was wonderful." "Yes," he said gently, "it was wonderful." He took the bag of apples from my hands and, groping inside, took out one of the smaller apples and put in a large one.
Henry, you're a young, hip poet. You were sort of born and raised here at the Writer's House on various kinds of experimental writing, on conceptual poetics, and here we are looking at what might be seen by a hip young guy like you as kind of old-fashioned. So where are you with Reznikov? I'm really curious, because we've never talked about Reznikov, you and I.
You know, after hearing Peter and Michelle talk about this and you, I think I'd have to agree that this is almost like a proto-conceptual, like, poetry of the everyday, where, like, you're sort of, he did just sort of take this instance, this one occurrence where he just was with this gentleman that he found on the street that he wouldn't have usually spoken to and decided to. And there isn't anything that's being defined here. I like that he's not trying to define anything. He's letting the moment speak for itself in a lot of ways. He's more interested in letting the mundane speak on its own terms instead of speaking for it. He's observing. He's not describing.
I guess I want to say that in 1975, when Charles Reznikov walked into the studios of WBIA to talk with Susan Howe, I wish I'd been a fly on the wall, because Susan was, you know, at that time really formulating what has become a certain poetics. Reznikov, obviously, toward the end of his career, what an interesting convergence. We could talk about this for a long time. What I want to do is ask each of you in turn just to add a final thought or final word to this conversation, something that maybe something particular that you had meant to say but didn't get a chance. I'm going to start with Michelle Taransky.
I'm going to throw out another term. I'm going to say documentary poetry, because that's how I've taught Reznikov in the past, though I think I'm going to bring this poem to my class and talk about this aside. Goldsmith, it's going to be good.
Great. Goldsmith, Reznikov, in your class, please report back the next time you're on Poem Talk. Henry Steinberg, your final thought.
I guess I am just struck by how much Reznikov set out to make a taxonomy of things and to make sure that nothing was forgotten. I was doing a little bit of research into his life before I came here today, and there was a family story that his grandfather was a poet, a Hebrew poet who never published any of his writings, and in fact all of his writings were lost after his death when his grandmother found them, didn't know what they were, couldn't read them, and threw them away. And that, like, as the story goes, is the reason why he was so hell-bent on having everything he wrote published, whether he had to do it himself, whether he had to publish it in some obscure journal, whether it, like, took 15 years, but it finally reached publication, because nothing could be lost. Everything must be remembered. Everything must be named, because it's just that important. And I guess, like,
almost a bearing witness to reality.
Yeah, it's fitting that he wrote a book called Testimony, exactly. Because it seems to me that's what his poetics is about. Testimony.
Thank you, Henry. Peter Cole, last thought?
I think my final thought would be picking up on something Michelle said. She mentioned she wanted to deal with him as a secular poet, not in terms of halacha, which is Hebrew for religious law. Well, a lot of the ways that people have talked about Reznikov over the course of the 20th century. Even when I first came to him in the 70s, most of my writer friends didn't like him very much. Well, this is not poetry. And even those who like some of his work, they often talk about him as a pedestrian poet. Well, pedestrian has to do with someone who walks. Mm. Reznikov was the ultimate walker. Walking in form literally gave form and metabolism and imagery and subject matter to everything this guy did. And so he is the ultimate pedestrian poet in the positive sense. And that brings us back to, again, this epigraph, because halakha in Hebrew means walking, walking on their way. It's the ultimate rabbinic quality is to be observant. And this is Reznikov. He's the halakhic, mishnaic poet, the pedestrian poet who lets us see the poetry in what everybody else calls prosaic.
Terrific. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, all three. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of what we call Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us, or maybe all three of you, to spread wide your narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or puff or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Michelle, you look like you're ready to gather some paradise.
Oh, yeah. I am excited about a book coming from LaFig's Press called I'll Drown My Book. It's an anthology of conceptual writing by women. And it was funded by Kickstarter. So it's awesome.
Terrific. Say the name of the title again.
I'll Drown My Book.
I'll Drown My Book. Peter Cole, will you gather some paradise for us?
Sure, with pleasure. I recently read Ben Lerner's book, Leaving the Atocha Station, which I just thought was absolutely marvelous. It brings together, I've always admired Ben's poetry, but I have to say I was not prepared for this book. I had heard about it. I'd heard it gotten good reviews. I'm usually, a year behind everything, 6 months behind by the time I find out about these things. But I read it a few months ago, and it just blew me away. The most embodied, there's more poetry in that prose. It's a book about poetry and about art. But he gets the most sort of radical approaches to the art. He finds a way to embody them in utterly accessible, warm, funny, brilliant, just kind of sparkling with a kind of intelligence narrative. And it's going to be quite an achievement.
Terrific. Thank you, Peter. Well, I have a little paradise. I mentioned before, but too briefly, that Peter Cole came here from New Haven, not just to be on Pump Talk, but to record some of his work on Pensound. So I urge everybody to go to Pensound and put Peter Cole in the search box and see what he's wrought. That's all the cake with raisins and nuts we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Henry Steinberg, Michelle Taransky, and Peter Cole, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, Chris Martin, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Julia Block in from the left coast, Katie Price here from Philly, and Anne Waldman coming down from New York by way of Colorado, no doubt, join me to talk about Bernadette Mayer's poem, The Tragic Condition of the Statue of Liberty. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us for that or another Poem Talk.